welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a wonderful weekend. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Kimberly Vositek is the Executive Director of the Red Cross in the Red River Valley. And this March, the Red Cross is offering free A1C testing for blood donors to help screen for diabetes. And Kimberly also will talk about what it means to volunteer for the Red Cross. And we begin today's Main Street with the Conversations on Healthcare with investigative journalist Charles Piller and his book, Doctored. He raises concerns about manipulated scientific images in Alzheimer's research. Hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner ask Piller to respond to criticism of his reporting, as well as explain other potential sources of hope in this research field.
Well, Charles, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being here.
You know, your book covers a really complex issue. I'm wondering if we can start by asking you to explain the allegations at the center of your investigation.
Sure. So what I try to do in the book is to examine some fundamental questions about disappointments, basically, in the progress towards finding remedies and eventually a cure for Alzheimer's disease. And as I think many listeners would know, there has been a period of great disappointment associated with Alzheimer's. For the last 30 plus years, there's been a dominant way of looking at the disease called the amyloid hypothesis. And even though there are a couple drugs now on the market associated with combating the disease that are directly tied to that hypothesis, their benefits have been at best extremely minimal and some would say even imperceptible to patients. And yet they also pose some very severe risks for a minority of patients who take the drugs. So what I tried to do is look really underneath all of that and to look deeply at the possibility that the research perhaps has gone astray in a variety of ways, including both a kind of groupthink associated with that hypothesis and also manipulation of some of the research that has skewed scientific thinking in the field.
Well, we understand that investigations are continuing, and several of the key people involved in those investigations have denied any knowledge of wrongdoing, but publications have withdrawn some research papers that have been submitted by scientists because of issues that you identified, and yet a mixed reaction to all of this from the scientific community. I'm sure it's very complicated, but what's the range of opinions that are coming forward?
Sure. Well, let me, if I may, give you a couple of examples that I think reflect some of the concerns and also the conflicts within the scientific community associated with my reporting and the investigations that I've done. So what kicked off this book and my years of research into this was an investigation that I did with the collaboration of forensic image experts into work done by a team of scientists at the University of Minnesota. The lead scientists were Sylvain Lesnay, who was at the time a postdoc in the lab of a very prominent Alzheimer's scientist, Karen Ash, at the University of Minnesota. Their study was very, very important in undergirding and supporting this idea that the amyloid hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease was essentially the central idea behind how to find remedies and eventual cures for Alzheimer's. And maybe just, if I could just digress very slightly to explain what that is specifically. Yeah. The amyloid hypothesis is this idea that these certain kinds of proteins that accumulate in the brain called amyloid proteins cause a cascade of biochemical effects that eventually lead to Alzheimer's dementia. And this idea has been prevalent in the field and has absorbed the lion's share of, you might say, mind share among scientists, and also the lion's share of funding for decades. And it's done this in part because it is a very logical way of thinking of it. You have this accumulation of proteins, you have some genetic association between the amyloid accumulation and Alzheimer's dementia. So it's something that scientists thought made a lot of sense, but unfortunately, the remedies developed based on it failed time after time after time. And So you had the ability to remove these amyloid proteins from the brain, but not to arrest or reverse the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Really, what we're all after is finding remedies to this terrible disease. And so in 2006, this experiment, this important experiment took place at the University of Minnesota that seemed to validate the amyloid hypothesis in a new and important way. It seemed to show a direct cause-effect relationship between a certain type of amyloid protein and a cognitive decline or memory loss in rats. And so it was an animal experiment, but it was such a strong validation that people in the field really felt that it had been a shot in the arm for validating this way of looking at it and really reinvigorated both funding and the idea of how to attack Alzheimer's disease and the way scientists were thinking in the field. And it made it so that this idea was kind of became renewed as a way of looking at the field. So, okay, fast forward to 2022, working in collaboration with a particular scientist at Vanderbilt University, Matthew Schrag, who has both image integrity assessment tools in his toolkit, and also is himself a neurologist who treats Alzheimer's patients and a neuroscientist who runs his own lab to study the disease. He found what appeared to be really central flaws in this experiment involving apparent image doctoring. And when I wrote an article about this in Science Magazine, exposing this range of apparent image doctoring in this very important study, the response was immediate and dramatic from the scientific community. So finally, if you'll forgive me, I'm getting back to your direct question, how has the scientific community been responding? And in this case, there were really two kinds of responses. Some scientists said, this is an opportunity for us to take a good hard look in the mirror and ask ourselves, do we need to broaden our horizons and give more emphasis to other ways of looking at the disease that might open up new horizons for understanding and treating Alzheimer's disease? Have we put too much faith in one way of looking at the disease? Others said, we believe that this is terrible, that there was apparent image manipulation associated with this study, but it doesn't mean anything. We're completely committed to the amyloid hypothesis. And many of them would say things like, we knew all along that this study was questionable. But it was very ironic because those same scientists, many of them leaders in the field, had cited this study over and over and over for many years as a one element of how they supported their own ideas in the field, how they believed and justified their own emphasis on this same hypothesis. So I would say that was at best ironic and at most a bit hypocritical. So that was the response initially.
Well, Charles, I wonder if I can, having gone broad on that, just curiosity, maybe go a little bit deep. Image doctoring, I think our listeners are probably trying to sort of figure out where the doctoring comes in. So let's just call it image manipulation or image distortion that we're talking about here. In your review, did you find that there's a standard process for layers of review? Generally speaking, there's the primary reviewer and maybe a secondary or even a tertiary reviewer before you would draw conclusions on something like this. Did you come away from it feeling like, yeah, there's good processes in place, so we don't know how this might have happened? Or did you come away from it thinking, gosh, maybe we don't have the level of secondary and tertiary review that lay people or even, you know, not lay people would think would be in place?
Sure. Well, let me start by telling you what my process is, and then I can put that into the context of what journals and regulators and funders do, because it's very different. So when I encounter allegations of inappropriate image doctoring on the part of Alzheimer's scientists, I put it through a very rigorous set of assessments that involve vetting the concerns very thoroughly. So the first way that I vet it is that I make sure that the analysis that is done has been done associated with my work, and that's done usually by very expert forensic image experts is vetted by others in that field. So in other words, I take their results of their examination of scientific images that apparently were doctored in ways to support improperly the hypothesis behind particular experiments. And I ask other forensic image experts, are these analyses well-founded and well-conducted? And if it passes that test, then I go to experts in the field of Alzheimer's research. So these are world-class experts who understand not just whether these images might be falsified, but also the meaningfulness of it. Are these important images? Are these images that fundamentally change the interpretation of an experiment that might have influenced the field in one direction or another? And if it passes both of those tests, then I go and I can write about it with confidence. Now, let's contrast that for a second with what has historically gone on at scholarly journals and at some of the major funders. There has not been often rigorous analysis of scientific images. And so what you have are a multitude of images, not just in Alzheimer's disease, but in many other areas that have slipped through, that have not been well examined, and that are in fact falsified or appear to be falsified and have not gotten the rigorous look that they should be getting in order to re-examine whether the experiments themselves are worth publishing. Now, let me just give you an example of something that I think we should all regard as a cautionary tale for the field of Alzheimer's research and more generally in science. So last fall, I wrote in the pages of Science magazine an article about an investigator by the name of Eliezer Moslia, who was until recently the head of the Division of Neuroscience of the National Institutes of Health. And as such, he had an instrumental role in guiding what research became funded and became important in the thinking of the scientific community regarding Alzheimer's and other neurological conditions. And because he was so important, I should say that he attained that job because he was a person who for decades had been a very influential researcher at the University of California, San Diego. And his work was among the most cited in the scientific literature, literally for decades. Now, what my story showed was that in more than 100 of his scholarly papers, there was strong evidence of improper image manipulation or reuse of images. These are studies that affected drug development and affected scientific thinking in profound ways. And when my story came out last fall, on the day it came out, the NIH synchronized its own announcement that he was no longer going to be the head of that division. And this was on the basis of them examining two studies, just two, out of the multitude of studies he wrote, and compared to the more than 100 studies that were evaluated in the dossier that was created as part of the work that I was doing for that article. He was then found to have been engaging in misconduct on just two studies. And I want to leave you with this little anecdote with a very sobering kind of capstone to it, which is that when I asked the National Institutes of Health if they had a practice of checking their top leadership for possible image manipulation in their studies prior to their being hired to these important jobs, the agency said no, and they didn't think that it would be beneficial to help with the conduct of research at the agency. This to me was a sign of complacency and arrogance that was stunning to me. It shows that we need more vigilance, more really just a better way of looking at these issues by these leaders in these agencies, and to understand that these are serious matters that can affect the way in which Alzheimer's research and other neuroscience research is conducted and how it affects the American public. So that sort of example shows me that we really do need reform. We need there to be a really invigorating way of changing the approach of these funding agencies. Similarly, at the scientific journals, there has been improvement. And I work for the journal Science, and I'm happy to report that Science and several other journals, many of the leading journals, have begun to take this issue more seriously and are beginning to approach this as a fundamental part of their due diligence process, which needs help and needs reinvigoration as well.
Well, that's very interesting. Charles, I want to pick up on a couple of things. So maybe there's two parts to this question. One, you're sort of talking about world-class experts, and then we're talking about America's research focus. It's not an American problem, Alzheimer's. It's a global problem. So are you finding the amyloid mafia internationally to exist in the EU and other large places where funding comes out of? And then what are you seeing on the horizon of alternative research into Alzheimer's that our listeners might be interested in hearing about seeing, knowing that the current strategy has not worked so successfully?
Thank you for that question. I think it's a very important one. First of all, I want to make it clear that even though I have written skeptically about the amyloid hypothesis and that many scientists share the view that there's been an overemphasis on the hypothesis, even the most strident skeptics of the amyloid hypothesis believe that amyloid proteins and the processes that they may be involved in the brain have something to do with Alzheimer's disease. The question is really not whether they have something to do, but whether they are the linchpin of Alzheimer's disease, whether in effect they have everything to do with the disease. And so personally, I think that research should continue into amyloid proteins and what impact they might have, but that research should and is being broadened to other ideas about the causes of Alzheimer's. And a couple that I am extremely interested in and I think are going to be fascinating to watch in the coming years. One is the possible impact of GLP-1 inhibitors. These are the seemingly miraculous drugs that are used for obesity and diabetes and now are being examined for lots of other ailments. And drugs like Wegovy and others that are already on the market are thought to possibly have an influence on Alzheimer's disease as well. And clinical trials, large-scale phase 3 trials, and these are normally the last set of trials prior to possible approval for use in the United States by the Food and Drug Administration. There are currently phase 3 trials going on with GLP-1 inhibitors that as early as next year, we may know some sort of conclusion about whether they might be beneficial for slowing or arresting the effects, the cognitive decline, I should say, of Alzheimer's disease. So that's one I'm really keeping my eye on. Another is the so-called infection hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease. This holds that latent infections in the brain, including with such viruses such as the herpes virus, which listeners may recall causes cold sores that resolve, and then they may not know that it can hang out in some organs of the body, including the brain, for up to decades, and are thought possibly to influence dementia in Alzheimer's dementia in people. And there are studies, clinical studies going on right now to examine the possible benefit of treating those latent viruses. So those are two very hopeful things. I think I should also say that people can have a very kind of despondency about Alzheimer's disease, a sense of hopelessness, because it's such a terrible ailment that steals our memories and our ability to function in everyday life, and ultimately, even for unlucky people who advanced Alzheimer's, our sense of self, the kind of elements of our personhood that can be so devastating to the people with Alzheimer's and their loved ones. But there is something that people should remember, that we have agency associated with this disease, that things like watching your blood pressure, your cholesterol levels, eating a healthful diet, exercising. There's no supplement or lifestyle habit that is the cure or absolute preventive to Alzheimer's disease. But these are all things that we have some degree of control over, and that living our best lives is also a way of helping to ensure that the worst symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, that if we're unlucky to eventually get the disease, can be forestalled or tempered by having these kinds of really deliberate habits that can be something that would benefit us in many ways as well.
Charles, we're living in a time of great mistrust of science, and one review of your book states that we're left wondering if any research can really be trusted. How do you answer that question?
Sure. This is a question that I welcome because I'm an investigative reporter and I've written critically of misconduct in science many times, not even just in Alzheimer's research. But let me say unequivocally that while there is misconduct in Alzheimer's research, it's a very small percentage of the overall research that's done. Just like any walk of life or any scientific field, a small number of scientists in this field engage in misconduct, cut corners, or even commit fraud in order to advance or to make money. And while this is reprehensible, it does not represent the vast bulk of scientists in the field. At times, people may misunderstand and extrapolate some doctored studies, some misconduct, to the idea that all of this research is suspect or all of this research cannot be trusted. And I would just object to that unequivocally and say that I think an enormous amount of incredibly good work continues to be done in the field.
And in fact, you're a founding member of the Center for Public Integrity, served on its board as its chair, I believe. I'm wondering if you can tell us about the center and its investigations into our healthcare system through the years. Tell us a little more about what's been exposed.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, the center has stopped operating recently. It has historically, it was a group that was dedicated to basically looking at not just misconduct, but also service in government and in industry and finding out what elements of our programs and our processes are not to be trusted and should be reexamined. And I'm not the best spokesperson for the entire legacy of that group. But what I can say is that investigative reporting overall is, you know, in a kind of way in which journalism is trying to play a positive role in society and unfortunately has suffered from funding cutbacks and an inability to get the degree of support that we need in order to do a robust job. Let me just say that I'm very grateful to Science Magazine for supporting me to do this very difficult and expensive work, time-consuming work. And the many nonprofit organizations have started to fill the gap when major news organizations have been unable to fund as much investigative reporting as they'd like to.
And maybe our group has not heard of, our listeners may not have heard of Science Magazine. Tell us a little bit about where they can get it and a little bit about its genesis as well.
Sure. Science Magazine is one of the preeminent scholarly journals in the world, and it publishes a wide range of basic scientific research, and along with the journal Nature is regarded as one of the two most important general interest scientific journals in the world. But the part of the book that I work for, and the book is a term of art in journalism for what a magazine is. And it's the journalism side of the magazine. And so I don't get involved in basic research. Of course, I'm not a scientist. But what I write about is important issues in science that deserve journalistic coverage and that would be of wider interest to the community, the public is at large, not just the scientific community. Science itself, though, is a quite influential publication. It's published by the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and it's a nonprofit. And so it's a membership organization, and it is an organization that exists to further the development of scientific research. That's in part why it's so important to me that people interpret my journalism is something that is very supportive of science, also very critical of science done poorly or improperly.
Well, Charles, I'm really glad you chose to end on that message. I think it's an important one for our listeners while they also absorb the other valuable information that you've provided our listeners with today. So thank you, Charles, for joining us. And thanks to our audience for being here.
That was a Conversations on Healthcare with investigative journalist Charles Piller and hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flintner. Conversations on Healthcare features in-depth discussions on health policy and innovation with industry newsmakers from around the globe, and you can learn more at chcradio.com. Coming up in the second half of Main Street Today, we'll visit with the Red Cross. Kimberly Vasateg is the executive director. We'll learn about a new program being launched this March that will give blood donors free A1C testing results. And we'll also talk about what it means to be a volunteer with the Red Cross. That's all coming up on Main Street after this news.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra presents Masterworks 4, Bliss, featuring Sonia Boska-Harrison, Saturday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 16th at 2 p.m. at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. Tickets at fmsymphony.org.
And we continue Main Street on this Monday with a discussion with Kimberly Vasateg. She's the executive director of the Red Cross throughout the Red River Valley. Kimberly, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me, Craig. I'm happy to be here.
We are excited that you are with us. You're a Fargo native. You've got deep ties to local businesses and government and nonprofit organizations. And here you are, the executive director of the Red Cross. I want to begin our conversation about a new initiative that happens for blood donors this March. The Red Cross is offering free A1C testing for all of its blood donors. What inspired the Red Cross to do that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a great initiative that we are putting forth. We're committed to providing generous donors with valuable information to maintain their health and well-being, and trying to bridge that gap in communities across the country. So we're just, by offering this, you know, it's just one more thing we can do for our community to help prevent further. Oh, I just messed up.
That's
sorry,
okay.
Craig.
That's okay. Go ahead and just complete the sentence as you would like. Kimberly, go right ahead. I'll just edit it out.
Yeah, so we are bridging the existing healthcare gaps in communities across the country by offering this, as we know that over one-third of Americans lack access to regular primary care. So this is just one way we can help our communities get the information that they need so they can maintain a healthy lifestyle.
So what do donors need to know about this process of getting their A1C tested when they give blood? And of course, A1C levels are an indication of either prediabetes or diabetes.
Yes, you're correct. You know, as a blood donor for the American Red Cross, you really don't need to know too much more. Our blood already goes through a couple of things of testing on the back end once it does get to our facilities. And this is just one more that we've added in. So those that have the American Red Cross blood app, that will come across once it's tested. And then we really suggest if there is a high or a low level that you go to your primary care or just make an appointment to get that checked out further by a doctor in your community.
Sure. About how long will it take once I give blood before I'm notified on my app of those results?
Yeah, so it's about 1 to 2 weeks, they're saying. So it's a quick turnaround. And even with our blood donor app, about that time, you are able to track where your donation is at. So you can even see where it's at locally at a storage facility, if it's begin its testing. And then we go all the way through to alert our donors to even where their blood ends up. So being able to see that throughout the country is a pretty cool thing that we're able to offer our blood donors.
Kimberly, are there any eligibility requirements or restrictions for those who want to participate in the free A1C testing?
There is not. So if you're eligible to give blood, we say, please come give. We're at a time right now in just in the calendar year. We usually come off a blood appeal in January, February, and we are starting to get a little bit low. So I think it's just one more way that we can see if we can get a couple more donors in the door so we can help provide that life-saving blood to someone that needs it.
All right, let's lay the groundwork here. For listeners who have never donated blood before, first, why should they consider it? And then, of course, what can they expect when they come in to give blood?
Yeah, so that is a great question. I think personally, this is one unique way to give back human to human. Blood is, you can't make that in a lab. It is really something that you are making a life-saving choice to donate your blood. So I think that goes far beyond any powers, I think, out there, which is an incredible thing to do. So that would be my pitch for those that are sitting on the, you know, the wing of saying, I don't know if I can do it, you know, the needles scare me or whatever it is. it is just it's a cool thing to make and to see the journey through the blood stage and see where it goes in a hospital. It's just a wonderful way to give back. And that, yeah, so, you know, when you show up at a Red Cross blood donation site, typically you go on your redcrossblood.org and you put your zip code in and you find the one closest to you. You schedule your appointment. And when you walk in, you're going to be greeted by volunteers. And I mean, what better way to start your day? They are fabulous people, our volunteers at the Red Cross. And then you know, you're going to sit down and do kind of a health history with one of the techs. They will do your hemoglobin. They'll test that. They'll test your blood pressure, your pulse, just making sure everything checks off. And then a tech will have you come sit on a comfortable bed and they will start the process. And really, I think, you know, it takes from actually sitting in the bed to being done. I think it depends on, you know, how fast your blood is moving that day. But really, it's only about 10 minutes that you're on that bed until the blood is ready to go. And you're done and back in the kind of like the recovery area, having some snack and some juice and having a good conversation with other blood donors.
How often can people give blood?
That's a great question. We are, so whole blood is 56 days. So in our community, we've been really planful and mindful of that we offer donations every other month, making sure that we're hitting the same time frame that people can schedule their donation right as they're finishing up the one they just left from. So every 56 days, we can do that. And then it's a little bit different when you start donating more of that plasma and other types of blood that we have the offer to.
What are some common myths about donating blood that might prevent people from giving? And can you debunk them?
You know, the common myth, that's a hard one. I think it's changed so much. Even in myself, you know, donating in the past, I just started becoming a more frequent donor as I started my role with the Red Cross. I would say to double check on everything, you know, you don't know until you go in and have that conversation. I think I've had questions about everything. I've traveled to here, I've traveled to there. Can I still donate? And we really don't know. So leave it to the professionals at the donation site, and they will be the ones to help debunk that myth.
How do we know that the Red Cross ensures the safety of our blood once we give it and the safety of us while we're giving it?
All of our technicians are well-trained individuals. So they are taking immense care of everyone. We have great bedside manner. And we are just making sure that the experience, the testing, and everything that we get back to, that your health is the main concern for us.
Kimberly, why is there a constant need for blood? I mean, to me, it's obvious, right? But it may not be to many. And who benefits the most from blood that's donated right here in North Dakota?
Yeah, that's a hard one. Blood is needed every single day. When you think of blood transfusions at our hospitals, our local hospitals are, you know, even our small community hospitals, blood transfusions are something happening every day. If it's a mom giving birth in a hospital and needs that other, you know, extra help just to get healthy after that, she's relying on that blood. And like I said, it's not something they can develop in a lab. So that is something that is, they use what's on their shelf. And once that starts running low, we're really having those doctors have to make those decisions. And that's just something that they already are under enough stress. We don't want them to stress on where that blood's coming from next. You know, it's just car accidents happen every single day. People are sick. You know, people with sickle cell have to have these blood transfusions on a common basis. And if we can help alleviate that stress on our hospitals, that's the goal. The Red Cross does supply over 40% of the nation's blood supply, and that really comes as the Minnesota Dakotas region. We are one of the top producers of blood for the American Red Cross, which is really, really fun to see.
That's cool.
That our
sure.
communities do. Yeah. So we don't, you know, it's a great thing to be proud of up here in the Midwest, that we are ones to roll up our sleeves. And, you know, we have the people that do it every single 56 days like clockwork, but we really need to get some more on board with the blood donation and get, you know, the younger generation or the ones that you said, you know, have those myths there that they just don't know are true. I encourage them to come in and have a conversation to learn more.
I remember the first time I gave blood, and then sometime later, maybe a week or two later, I got my card in the mail, I think, and I learned that I have a fairly rare blood type. I was young, I think I was in college, and I just didn't know. And so I found that to be
right.
Very interesting, and I'm sure people will understand what their blood type is at the very least by giving blood with the Red Cross.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the cool thing too. When you do find out if you are, you know, the universal donor or if you can accept from everyone, you know, it just gives you a little bit more knowledge of yourself and your body. So being, you know, we always look for the O donors just because, you know, that's just something we always look for because they are either a universal donor or else they can receive blood from anyone. But yeah, that universal O negative would just be like phenomenal if we get all O negatives to come in just to help on that high demand that we always see with the hospitals. But we accept all blood types, no matter what it is. And, you know, if you have the opportunity to give that plasma or that whole blood, that's amazing too.
And I should point out that regardless of your blood type, all blood types are needed. It's not just one over the other. Kimberly, beyond blood donation, let us know other ways that people can get involved with the Red Cross here in North Dakota.
Yeah, we would love for people to volunteer. Our volunteers are phenomenal. It is absolutely something that I have learned throughout my journey working with the Red Cross this last year that we can't do anything without our volunteers. They are phenomenal people, individuals. And just they come with a wealth of knowledge and the wealth of knowledge of their own communities that we won't know. You know, I try my hardest, but I have 36 counties that I am responsible for of trying to know what's going on, get feet on the ground. But those volunteers are the true people that we need to step up for their communities. And that's really just a fun way to give back. You know, you already know your neighbors. Let's see if we can help them a little bit more when they have that devastating fire or a disaster does strike your community. It's, you know, when the Red Cross comes, we want to make sure we have the right people to talk to get you back on the road to recovery. So volunteering is my absolute joy, working with everyone and seeing all those volunteers come in the door.
We are enjoying our conversation with Kimberly Vasateg. She's the executive director of the Red Cross and has responsibilities here in North Dakota and in Minnesota. Kimberly, talk more about volunteering and then what it means down the road. You talked briefly about serving when disasters strike, when fires strike. Give us a little more detail of the services and the preparation that the Red Cross provides and the preparation then that's done to be ready, because you never know.
Right. It is true. I mean, we've been going for a very long time on a continuous disaster response as the Red Cross, not locally, but nationally. So we do take pride in our, you know, just getting the education, getting the training is needed for our volunteers that are in the field. So if that's someone here, called it a recovery as a disaster action team member, if they're the ones going out to a local fire to make sure that there is a, you know, a neighbor to neighbor kind of transaction happening, you know, we don't want it to be a, hey, I'm sorry about the fire and kind of leave. We're going to be here with you throughout that whole entire experience and give you a human to talk to and give you, you know, a hug, those nice things that people just they forget to do. So we want to move away from all that and make sure that it is that transformational piece. But with the education and the training, we're really trying to get our volunteers to help and when that national disaster happens. So All volunteers start local, but when you go and you look at, we'll say the California wildfires, that just, you know, they're still going on. We're still out there as Red Cross boots on the ground. But that's really taking our volunteers here locally and empowering them to raise their hand to go out to those national disasters and help and be, you know, a kind face and a smiling face and just help move things along into that mode of recovery. So it's a really incredible thing that we're able to offer, even as leaders. You know, that's a leadership opportunity for a lot of people to come in the door as a Red Cross volunteer and work your way up. And, you know, you never know if you could be a job director of a level 5, level 6 disaster. And that's a huge accomplishment and a reward in itself as a leader. And if people are wanting to do that and give back, it's a great way to do it.
Kimberly, you recently came back from North Carolina where you helped with the destructive hurricanes that hit the area. What did you do?
I was so honored to be able to raise my hand. Being deployed is an honor for any volunteer and staff member. So being able to work it out with my husband here locally and having 3 kids and just the whole executive director job and all of that fun stuff. But being able to raise my hand, I flew down to Charlotte, North Carolina about 2 or 3 days after Helene hit. And the role that I have when I have my volunteer hat on is elected official liaison. And so kind of the same role that I have as face of the Red Cross and executive director here locally. My job is to connect with all elected officials and make sure everything is okay, ask questions, you know, bring up things that are missing or not there yet in communities and really just help be that connecting piece to our EOC that is current, like, you know, when, oh gosh, when a disaster happens, an EOC is the first thing that is put together by a lot of people. So being able to have my group down there helping and being in different counties and have that boots on the ground, it was an incredible experience for sure.
The destruction inland there was just surprising to me. Is that what you experienced?
Yes. You know, when I drove from Charlotte up to around Boone, North Carolina. So I was really out of that area, but it was just incredible. I don't personally understand. There have been around those mountains before in my life. So taking a car after I got to headquarters and venturing out on my own, you know, seeing massive amount of trees and people, you know, just, you know, they're there, but you're able to drive through them because of the need of the roadways to remain clear. It was incredible to see. Gosh, it was just incredible. Really, in where I was at in the Boone area, I was able to be outside of a Walmart to do some feeding to the community. And the Walmart behind me was getting completely gutted. It had had like 6 to 8 feet of water in it. And by that time I got there 3 days later, all the water was gone. But it was just incredible, you know, to see the water lines, to go, you know, just, I don't even know what direction I was in, but just to go right behind the Walmart and have a community, a trailer home community, you know, and they're completely wiped out. It was just, you can't understand. I mean, coming from here, we probably do understand it the most, the flooding part of it. But where they were and the terrain that we were in was just a unique obstacle. We had helicopters flying over our heads all the time. You know, it's driving into following, you know, driving and just following directions on your phone so you don't get lost. Being alerted to that you were in a hurricane zone in the middle of North Carolina was a little bit odd. But those directions would take you hours. You know, they'd have to divert you because a whole road washed out and it's no longer there. I heard stories of fire trucks floating down a street. And, you know, it's that search and rescue, too. That was such an incredible thing that when you look at the disasters and how much goes into the response, yeah, it took me a long time. And every single day, I still am thankful for that experience. And I'm still learning more, even talking with you today. And that was months ago.
Everyone can volunteer.
The only age part would be we would need you, you know, 18 typically would be the only thing, but we do take some youth volunteers to help around and do office things and other kind of community events as well. But when you start talking about the traveling and all of that, it is definitely, we want to make sure that you can go and that you're safe doing so.
Kimberly, I remember the first time I was touched by the Red Cross, and it was in our local Riverton, Wyoming Learn to Swim program by Mrs. Tonkin and Mrs. Gamble. And we got our little Red Cross certificate that we had passed this level, then this level. So that happened every summer for years. Do you remember the first time that you learned of the Red Cross?
You know, I do. I remember taking the CPR courses. CPR courses because I was a babysitter. You know, I think took the babysitting class. So that's a fun way to just to kind of get the touch of it. Otherwise, you know, and that's the crazy thing. It's, you don't really remember back how far. I don't even remember how old I was that I got the CPR and babysitting, but the fact that we're still doing it, you know, we're still known for it. Things still happen here in our communities. You know, the CPR AED training, we have that going, you know, it's the swimming training for sure. And it's just that preparedness piece of like a safety town. You know, I don't even know if they have safety town anymore in communities, but just learning the basics of what happens when you have a home fire, right? Like, I think I heard a story that was just heartbreaking. You know, we go in and do these free smoke alarm installations, and one of our volunteers asked a child, well, where would you go if your smoke alarms went off and you had a fire in your house? And this child looked and said, well, I go out, hide under my bed. And as a parent, my heart, when I heard that, I was, you know, like, oh no, like there's just the education just isn't there. So making sure our kiddos know where to go after a fire or during a fire, or even when the smoke alarm goes off, like that's a huge piece as the Red Cross. And just making sure we're prepared for that.
Kimberly, besides volunteering, the Red Cross needs fiscal support. All of us have seen news about donating our money and being then unsure of what happens to it. But it seems to me the Red Cross is always singled out for managing money correctly. What would you tell folks about what happens when they donate to the Red Cross?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, empowering yourself if you are in the means to give, you can designate the funds. Ask where you can designate them. We are more than happy to give you options of where you can designate your funds. If you want it to stay local, that is what we will honor it with. And I think that when you start looking at a national organization like we are, you have the ability. It's your money. You can tell us where to put it. You know, and I love that part about the Red Cross. We just came off of an amazing Giving Hearts Day, which was just phenomenal. To go back here, you know, local and support our preparedness for our volunteers, you know, support the disaster preparedness pieces that we have to just make sure our communities are ready to go when and if something were to happen. Or like I said, train those volunteers so they can feel empowered to go to the next natural disaster and give back.
Where can people get more information about what you do here locally, Kimberly, for the Red Cross?
I would say our Facebook page would probably be the best one, as that is the most updated with kind of the events that are going around here in the eastern side of the state and even the western side of the state. And then we also have a regional Facebook page as well that I would say the Minnesota Dakotas, we do a phenomenal job. You know, we have events all the time. There's nothing ever not to do. So it's just a way to give back and stay involved. And if anyone has questions, they can definitely just look on the Facebook site, or else you can go to redcross.org to learn more about the whole entire organization.
My guest has been Kimberly Vasateg. She's the executive director of the Red Cross throughout the Red River Valley. And she and I have discussed the Red Cross's blood donation program, which now will offer free A1C testing for blood donors this March. Kimberly, it's been a pleasure, and best wishes to you and what you do for the Red Cross.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing David Cross, the end of the beginning of the end, to the Fargo Theater on Saturday, May 17th. Ticket information available at jadepresents.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 3rd. On this date, in 1906, Wahpeton papers refuted reports that Reverend Edmonds was alive and well with a woman who was not his wife. The sudden disappearance of Reverend Edmonds had become the subject of much speculation and gossip. Some suspected foul play or suicide, and newspapers continued to offer various theories about the case. Fargo and Grand Forks papers reported that a Wahpeton man claimed to have seen Edmonds in Winnipeg with a woman. Mrs. Edmonds and her daughter had gone back east, believing her husband was dead. Edmonds was last seen walking by the Red River on December 21st. He had long been outspoken about the moral state of Wahpeton, publishing newspaper editorials condemning saloons, bootleggers, and prostitution. His followers applauded him, while his critics mocked him, with one editor dismissing Edmonds as a temperance crank. Wahpeton papers asserted that Edmonds had simply fallen into the river and that his body would be recovered in the spring. The man who thought he saw Edmonds alive was questioned and admitted his mistake. It was later revealed that Edmonds had resigned from the Congregational Church and planned to leave Wahpeton in the spring. His followers were disheartened by both his departure and his apparent demise. Edmonds had graduated from Dartmouth College and Andover Theological Seminary. A special diving unit was called to Wahpeton to search for Edmonds' body. A crowd gathered to watch, but after 2 weeks, the operation failed. The search resumed in the spring, and Edmonds' body was found less than a mile downriver. It was theorized that he had fallen into a hole cut in the ice for watering stock, and his hat was found floating in the hole at the time of his disappearance. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We would like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public. And that's a wrap for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on the show, my guest will be Darcy Backegaard. She's the co-founder of the Educators Lab, an organization dedicated to empowering teachers as change agents in their communities, and she's based right here in North Dakota. We'll discuss the Teacher Empowerment Incubator, its efforts to combat teacher burnout, support rural educators in North Dakota, and foster innovative, teacher-led solutions to improve student learning and school communities. And we'll learn about its relationship to Valley City State University. That's all ahead tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.